So chapter 3 of The Iron Man by Ted Hughes. What's to be done with the Iron Man? So the spring came round the following year, and leaves unfurled from the buds. Daffodils speared up from the soil, and everywhere the grass shook, new green points. The round hill over the Iron Man was covered with new grass. Before the end of the summer, sheep were grazing on the fine grass on the lovely hillock, and people who had never heard of the Iron Man saw the green hill as they drove past on their way to the sea. And they said, "What a lovely hill. What a perfect place for a picnic." So people began to picnic on top of the hill, and soon quite a path was worn up there by people climbing to eat their sandwiches and take snaps of each other. One day, a father and mother and a little boy and a little girl stopped their car and climbed the hill for a picnic. They had never heard of the Iron Man, and they thought the hill had been there forever. They spread a tablecloth on the grass and set down the plate of sandwiches, a big pie, a roasted chicken, a bottle of milk, a bowl of tomatoes, a bag full of boiled eggs, a dish of butter and a loaf of bread with cheese, salt, and cups. Wow. The father got his stove going to boil some water for tea, and they all lay back on the rug munching food and waiting for the kettle to boil. Suddenly, the father said, "That's funny." "What is it?" asked Mother. "I felt the ground shake," the father said. "Here, right beneath us." "Probably an earthquake in Japan," said the mother. "An earthquake in Japan?" cried the little boy. "How could that be?" So the father began to explain how an earthquake, in a far distant country that shakes down buildings and empties lakes, sends a jolt right around the earth. People far away in other countries feel it as nothing more than a slight trembling of the ground. An earthquake that knocks a city flat in South America might do no more than shake a picture off the wall in Poland. But as the father was talking, the mother gave a little gasp and a yelp. "The chicken! The cheese! The tomatoes!" Everybody sat up. The tablecloth was sagging in the middle as they watched. The sag got deeper and the food fell into it, dragging the tablecloth right down into the ground. The ground under the tablecloth was splitting, and the tablecloth, as they watched slowly, folded and disappeared into the crack. And they were left staring at a jagged black crack in the ground. The crack grew and widened and lengthened. It ran between them. The mother and the girl were on one side, and the father and the boy were on the other. The little stove toppled into the growing crack with a clatter, and the kettle disappeared. They could not believe their eyes. They stared at the widening crack. Then, as they watched, an enormous iron hand came up through the crack, groping around in the air, feeling over the grass on either side of the crack. It nearly touched little boy, and he rolled over backwards. The mother screamed. "Run to the car!" shouted the father as they all ran. They jumped into the car and drove, and did not look back. So they did not see the great iron head, square like a bedroom, with red glaring headlamp eyes, with a tablecloth still with chicken and the cheese draped across the top of it, rising out of the top of the hillock as the Iron Man freed himself from the pit. When the farmers realized that the Iron Man had freed himself, they groaned. What could they do now? They decided to call the army who could pound him to bits with anti-tank guns. But Hogarth had another idea. At first the farmers would not hear of it, least of all his own father, but at least they agreed. Yes, they would give the idea a trial, and if it failed, they would call in the army. After spending a night and day eating all the barbed wire for miles around, as well as hinges, he tore off gates and tin cans he found in ditches, and three new tractors, two cars and a lorry, the Iron Man was resting in a clump of elm trees. There he stood, leaning among the huge branches, amongst it, almost hidden by the dense leaves. His eyes glowed a soft blue. The farmers came near along a lane in cars, so they could make a quick getaway if things went wrong. They stopped 50 yards from the clump of trees. He really was a monster. This was the first time most of them had had a good look at him. His chest was big as a big cattle truck, and his arms were like cranes. But he was getting rusty, probably from eating all the barbed wire. Now Hogarth walked up towards the Iron Man. "Hello," he shouted. "Hello, Mr. Iron Man." The Iron Man made no move. His eyes did not change. Then Hogarth picked up the rusty old horseshoe and knocked it against a stone. Clonk, clonk. At once the Iron Man's eyes turned darker blue, then purple, then red, and finally white, like car headlamps. It was the only sign he gave of having heard. "Mr. Iron Man," said Hogarth, "we've got all the iron you want, all the food you want, and you can have it all for nothing if you'll stop eating up the farms." The Iron Man stood up straight. Slowly he turned till he was looking directly at Hogarth. "We are sorry we trapped you and buried you. We promise we'll not deceive you again. Follow us and you can have all the metal you want. Brass too, aluminium, lots of old chrome." The Iron Man pushed aside the boughs and came into the lane. Hogarth joined the farmers. Slowly they drove back down the lane, and slowly, with all his cogs humming, the Iron Man stepped after them. They led through the villages, and half of the people came out to stare. Half ran to shut themselves inside the bedrooms and kitchens, and nobody could believe their eyes when they saw the Iron Man marching behind the farmers. At last they came into the town, and there was a great, great scrap metal yard. Everything was there, old cars by the hundreds, old trucks, railway engines, stoves, refrigerators, springs, bedsteads, bicycles, girders, gates, pans, and all the scrap iron of the region was piled up there, rusting away. "There," cried Hogarth, "all you can eat." The Iron Man gazed, and his eyes turned red. He kneeled down in the yard, stretched out on one elbow, and picked up a greasy black stove, and chewed it like a toffee. There were delicious crumbs of chrome on it. He followed that with a double-decker bedstead, and the brass knobs made his eyes crackle with joy. Never before had the Iron Man eaten such delicacies. As he lay there, a big truck turned into the yard to unload a pile of rusty chain. The Iron Man lifted a handful and let it dangle into his mouth, better than any spaghetti. So there they left him. It was an Iron Man's heaven. The farmers went back to their farms, and Hogarth visited the Iron Man every few days. And now the Iron Man's eyes were constantly a happy blue. He was no longer rusty, and his body gleamed blue, like a new gun barrel. He ate and ate and ate, endlessly. Chapter 4. The Space Being and the Iron Man. One day there came strange news. Everybody was talking about it. Round eyes, busy mouths, frightened voices, and everyone was talking about it. One of the stars of the night sky had begun to change. This star had always been a very tiny star of no importance at all. It had shone up there for billions and trillions and zillions of years in the constellation Orion. The great shape of the giant hunter that strides across the space, across space on autumn and winter nights. In all its time, the tiny star had never changed in any way. Now suddenly it began to get bigger. Astronomers peering through their telescopes noticed it first. They watched it with worried frowns, and the tiny star was definitely getting bigger. And not just bigger, but bigger and bigger and bigger. Each night it was bigger. Bigger than a dog star, then larger, the large coloured twinkler at the heel of the hunter Orion. Bigger than Jupiter, the great blazing planet. Everyone could see it clearly night after night, as it grew and grew and grew. They stared up with frightened faces, till at last it hung there in the sky, over the world, blazing down, the size of the moon, a deep, gloomy red. And now there could be only one explanation. The star was getting bigger because it was getting nearer, and nearer and nearer. It was rushing towards the world, faster than a bullet, faster than any rocket or meteorite. And if it hit the world at that speed, why, the whole world would simply be blasted into bits in the twinkling of an eye. It would be like an express train hitting a bowl of goldfish. No wonder people stared up with frightened faces, and no wonder the astronomers watched it through their telescopes with worried frowns. But all of a sudden, a strange thing happened. The star seemed to have stopped. It hung, a deep gloomy red, just the size of the moon. It got no smaller and it got no bigger. and it wasn't coming any nearer. But it wasn't going away either. Now everybody tried to explain why and how this was happening and what had happened. What was happening and what was going to happen. And now that the next strange thing occurred, the astronomers noticed it first. In the middle of the giant star, a tiny black speck had appeared. On the second night, the speck seemed to be wiggling, wriggling, and much bigger. On the third night, you could see it without a telescope, a struggling black speck in the centre of the giant red gloomy star. On the fifth night, the astronomers saw that it seemed to be either a bat or a black angel or a flying lizard, a dreadful silhouette, flying out of the centre of that giant star straight towards the Earth. What was coming out of the giant star? Each night when the astronomers returned to their telescopes to peer, this black flying horror was bigger, with slow, gigantic wing beats, with long, slow writhings of its body. It was coming down through space, outlined black against its red star. Within a few more nights, its shape had completely blotted out the red star, and the nameless, immense bat angel was flying down at the Earth, like a great black swan. It was definitely coming straight at the Earth. It took several days to cover the distance. Then, for one awful night, its wings seemed to be filling most of the sky. The moon peered fearfully from low on the skyline, and all the people of the Earth stared up, gazing in fear at the huge black movement of the wings that filled the night. Next morning it had landed on Australia. The shock of it landing rolled round the Earth like an earthquake, spilling teacups in London and jolting pictures off the wall in California and cracking statues off their pedestals in Russia. The thing had actually landed. It was a terrific dragon. Terribly black and terribly scaly and terribly knobbly, terribly horned, terribly hairy and terribly clawed, terribly fanged with vast, iridescent, terrible eyes, each one as big as Switzerland. There it sat, covering the whole of Australia with its tail and trailing away all over Tasmania and into the sea. Its foreclaws on the headlands of the Gulf of Carpentaria. Luckily, the mountains and hills propped up its belly clear of the valleys, and the Australians could still move about in the pitch darkness under the new sky. This low, queer covering of scales, they crowded towards the light that came in along its sides. Of course, whoever had been on a mountaintop when the dragon landed had been squashed flat, and nothing could be done about that. And there the horror sat, glaring over the countries of the world. What had it come for, and what was going to happen now that this monstrosity had arrived? Everybody waited. The newspapers spoke about nothing else. Aircraft flew near this space. Bat, angel, dragon, taking photos. It lay over Australia, higher than any of the mountains, higher than the Hindu Kush in Asia, and its head alone was the size of Italy. For a whole day, while the people of Earth trembled and wept and prayed to God to save them, the space bat angel dragon lay resting its chin, sunk into the Indian Ocean and the sea, not quite up to its bottom lip. But the next morning, early, its giant voice came rumbling around the world. The space bat angel was speaking. It wanted to be fed. And what it wanted to eat was living things. People, animals, forests. It didn't care which, so long as the food was alive. But it had better be fed quickly, otherwise it would roll out its tongue longer than the Trans-Siberian Railway and lick huge swathes of life off the surface of the earth, cities, forests, farmlands, wherever there was, it would leave the whole world looking like a charred pebble, unless it was fed and fed quickly. Its voice shook and rumbled around the earth for a whole hour as it delivered its message. Finally, it ended and it lay waiting. The people of the world got together. If they fed it, how could they ever satisfy it? It would never be full. And every new day it would be as hungry as ever. How can you feed a beast the size of Australia? Australia is a vast land, and all the countries of Europe will fit easily into Australia. The monster's stomach alone must be the size of Germany. No, they would not feed it. The people of the world decided they would not feed this space bat, angel, dragon, or whatever it was. They would fight it. They would declare war on it, and all got together to blast it off the face of the earth. And so it was that all the peoples of Earth declared war on the monster and sent out their armed forces in grand combined cooperation. What a terrific attack. Rockets, projectiles, and all sorts of missiles and bombs and shells and flamethrowers. Everything was tried. The smoke of the explosions drifted out over the Pacific like a black crawling continent. The noise of the battle shook the world almost as much as the landing of the dragon had done, and for much longer. The noise died down and the smoke cleared, and all the peoples of the world cried in dismay. The dragon was actually smiling. Smiling! Aircraft flying daringly near photographed the vast face smiling, and the picture was in the papers. It was smiling as if it had been tickled. Now the peoples of the world were worried. They were all great fighters and all spent their spare money on preparing for war, always making bigger and better weapons, and now they had all tried their utmost to blast this thing off the earth. And what was the result? The dragon merely smiled, and there was not a scratch could be seen anywhere on its body. Human weapons had no effect. But that wasn't surprising. The creature had come from the depths of space, out of the heart of a star, and nobody knew what it was made of. Perhaps it could not be destroyed by any means whatsoever. And now the space bat angel spoke again. It gave the people of the world 1 week in which to prepare its first meal. They could prepare what it liked, said the dragon, but if the meal was not ready in a week, then he would start on the cities and the towns. The people of the earth, the kings and presidents and ministers and the farmers and the factory workers, as office workers, began to lament. Now what would happen to them? They would like to say the monster didn't exist, but how could they? There it was, covering Australia, staring out all over the countries of the world. Now the little boy, Hogarth, heard all about this. Everybody in the world was talking about it and worrying about it. He was sure the Iron Man could do something. Compared to the space bat angel dragon, the Iron Man wasn't very big, of course. The Iron Man was only the size of a tree. Nevertheless, Hogarth had faith in the Iron Man. He visited the Iron Man in the scrapyard and talked to him about the great monster that was threatening the earth. Please, he asked, please can you think of a way of getting rid of it? If you can't, then it's the end of us all. The Iron Man chewed thoughtfully at his favourite titbit, a juicy, spicy old gas stove. He shook his head slowly. Please think of something, cried Hogarth. If the space bat angel dragon licks all the life off the earth, that'll be the end of your scrap iron, and there'll be no people left to make it. The Iron Man became still. He seemed to be thinking. Suddenly his headlamps blazed red, green and blue and white all at once. He stood up in a great grinding voice and gave his commands, and Hogarth danced for joy. The Iron Man had the most stupendous idea. The Iron Man would go out as a champion of the earth against the monster from space. There was no time to be wasted. The Iron Man allowed himself to be taken to pieces, his arms and legs and body and head all separate, so each part could be flown out to Australia on a different airline. He was too big to be flown all in one piece. At the same time, a ship sailed from China loaded with great iron girders, and another ship sailed from Japan loaded with fuel oil. The Iron Man had ordered these, the girders and the oil, and a team of engineers were unloaded on the beach of northern Australia, near the space bat angel dragon's neck. Then the Iron Man's parts were landed at the same spot, and the engineers fitted him together. He stood up on the beach and shouted his challenge. Sit up, he roared. Sit up and take notice, you great space lizard. The space bat angel dragon sat up slowly. He had never noticed the fussing of the boats and the aeroplanes down there on the beach near his neck, and now he gazed in surprise as the Iron Man, who seemed very tiny to him, though his voice was big enough. The Iron Man spoke again. I challenge you, he shouted, to a test of strength. A test of strength? The space bat angel dragon couldn't believe his ears. A tiny little creature like the Iron Man challenging him to a test of strength? He simply laughed loud and long and peered down at the Iron Man. While the echo of his laugh was still rolling around the earth, he peered down out of the sky at this odd little thing on the beach, with even tinier men scuttling around him. "And if I can prove myself stronger than you are, then you must promise to become my slave," cried the Iron Man. The dragon smiled. Aircraft flew around watching this amazing conversation between the space bat angel dragon and the Iron Man. Ships out at sea watched through telescopes. "And if you don't accept my challenge," shouted the Iron Man, "then you're a miserable coward, cowardly reptile not fit to bother with." The space bat angel dragon was so astounded that he agreed. Why, he thought when this silly little creature was finished, had finished his antics, "I'll just lick him up." So the monster agreed and waited and watched to see what the test of strength was to be. After all, if he wanted to, he could flatten the Iron Man with one eyelash. The engineers had fastened all the girders together in the shape of a grid. A huge iron bed, the size of a house. Under this, they had made a steel-lined pit. Now they poured fuel oil into the pit, and the space bat angel dragon watched. Now they lit the fuel oil, and the flames roared up fiercely through the bars of the grid. Now the space bat angel dragon got his first shock. The Iron Man stretched himself out on his back on the grid among the flames, his ankles crossed and his hands folded behind his head, just as if he were in a bed, while the flames raged under and around him. The monster stared down, and the Iron Man smiled up out of the mist of the flames. The flames became fierce, and the grid became red hot, and the Iron Man's hair and elbows and toes became red hot. His body became first blue, then black, and then began to glow. He was getting red hot. Still he smiled up at the monster, and still the flames grew fiercer. And now the Iron Man was entirely red hot. Pretty soon he was almost white hot. And still he smiled, out of white hot eyes and with white hot lips. And all the time the space bat angel dragon stared down in astonishment. But now the fuel oil was all burned away. Suddenly the flames died, flickering, and went out. The white-hot Iron Man sat up, stood up, got stiffly off his glowing bed, and began to walk to and fro on the sand, cooling. He cooled slowly, and he went back from white to orange, from orange to red, from red to black, as he walked, coolly swinging his arms. Now at last he spoke to the monster. "If you can't bear to be made red-hot like me, then you are weaker than I am, and I have won, and you are my slave." "All right," said the monster, "build the fire and I'll iron it." He laughed again, and he knew the Iron Man couldn't build a fire the size of Australia, but then his laugh stopped. The Iron Man was pointing upwards at the sun. "There is the fire for you. You go and lie there. Go and lie on the sun until you're red hot." The monster gazed up at the sun and felt strangely cold. Suddenly, but how could he refuse? "All right," as he set off. With slow giant wing beats, he lifted his immense body off the earth and flew slowly up towards the sun, where the whole earth watched. Slowly he covered the distance, getting smaller and smaller, and at last he landed, a ragged black shape sprawled across the sun. Everybody watched now and saw that the monster began to glow, blue at first and then red, then orange, and finally his shape was invisible, the same blazing white as the sun itself. The monster was white hot on the sun. They saw him returning, a blazing shape, tearing itself off the sun. This shape became red as it flew. It was writhing and growing larger. Slowly once more it became the black bat winged shape of the dragon flying back to earth, bigger and bigger and cooling as it came, until bump, he landed, this time much more heavily than before, on Australia. He landed so heavily that all the world's bells tumbled out of church towers and birds' eggs were jarred out of their nests. The monster stared down at the Iron Man, but it was hardly the same monster. His horns drooped, his face was wizened and black, and his claws were scorched and burnt, and his crest floppy all over limply, and great ragged holes were burned in his wings. It had been terrible for him in the fires of the sun, but he had done it, and he was here. The fires of the sun are far, far hotter than any fires here on Earth can ever be. There, he roared, I've done it. The Iron Man nodded, but his answer was to signal to the engineers. Once more they poured oil into the trough under the grid, and once more they lit it. Once more the flames roared up and the black smoke billowed into the clear blue. And once more the Iron Man stretched himself out on the grid of the raging furnace. The Space Bat Angel Dragon watched in horror. He knew what was meant for him. He would have to go once more to the sun. And now the Iron Man's hair and toes and elbows were red hot. He lay back on the flames, smiling up at the dragon, and his whole body was becoming red hot, then orange, and finally white. At this point, the Iron Man was terribly afraid, for what would happen if the flames went on getting fiercer and fiercer? He would melt. He would melt and drip into the flames like so much treacle, and that would be the end of him. So even though he grinned up at the dragon as though he were enjoying the flames, he was not enjoying them at all, and he was very, very frightened. Even the engineers who were hiding behind thick asbestos screens over a mile away along the beach felt the hair singeing on their heads, and they thought too it was the end of the Iron Man. Perhaps they poured in just too much fuel oil. But at that moment, the very second the edge of the Iron Man's ear started to melt, the fuel was used up and the flames died. The engineers came running down to the beach and saw that the Iron Man was getting off his fearful bed, and they saw him moving to and fro on the sand, cooling off. At last the Iron Man looked up at the dragon. He could hardly speak after his ordeal in the flames. Instead, he simply pointed towards the sun. He gazed up at the monster. That's twice, he managed to say. Now it's your turn. The monster did not laugh. He set off from the earth, beating his colossal wings, writhing his long ponderous body up to the sky towards the sun. He did not laugh. Last time had been too dreadful, but he went. He couldn't let the Iron Man win. He couldn't let the Iron Man of the Earth beat him in his terrible contest. So all the telescopes and cameras of the world watched him fly into the sun, saw him land among the flames as before, and saw the great ragged shape like an ink blot sprawled over the sun. They saw him began to glow red and orange, and at last they could no longer see him. He and the sun were blinding whiteness. He had done it again, but the sun was burning him. He had melted in the sun. Where was he? No, here he was. Slowly down through space, much more slowly than before. His white-hot flying body cooled slowly to red as he came, and as he grew larger, coming nearer, he finally became once more black. And the great black shape flagged its way down through space until bump. Heavier than ever, he landed on Australia. This time the bump was so heavy, it knocked down certain skyscrapers, sent tidal waves sweeping into harbours, and threw herds of cows on their back all over the world. The Space Bat Angel Dragon landed so ponderously because he was exhausted, and now he was a very changed monster. The fires of the sun had worked on him in a way that was awful to see. His wings were only rags of what they had been. His skin was crisped, and all his fatness had been changed by the fires of the sun into precious stones, jewels, emeralds, rubies, turquoise, and substances that had never been found on Earth. And when he landed with such a jolt, these loads of precious gems burst through the holes of his scorched skin and scattered down onto the Australian desert beneath. But the Iron Man could not allow himself to pity the Space Bat Angel Dragon, and he signalled to the engineers for round three. And the engineers began to pour oil, but that was it. But what was this? An enormous woofing sound, a booming, wheezing, sneezing. If the Iron Man got to the furnace again, it would mean that he, the monster, would have to take another roasting, and he could not stand another. "Enough! Enough!" he roared. "No," replied the Iron Man, "I feel like going on. We only have had two each. It's enough. It's too much. I can't stand another. The fires of the sun are too terrible for me. I submit." "Then I've won," shouted the Iron Man, "because I'm quite ready to roast myself red hot for you again. If you don't, then I've won." "You've won, yes, you've won, and I'm your slave," cried the space dragon, space bat angel dragon. "I'll do anything you like, but not the sun again." And he plunged his chin into the Pacific to cool it. "Very well. From now on, you are the slave of Earth. What can you do?" "Alas, I'm useless, utterly useless. All we do is fly in space or make music." "Music? What sort of music?" "Haven't you heard of the music of the spheres?" asked the dragon. "It's the music that space makes to itself. All the spirits inside all the stars are singing. I'm a star spirit. I sing too. The music of the spheres is what makes space so peaceful." "Then whatever made you want to leave and eat up the earth? If you were so peaceful up there, how did you get such greedy and cruel ideas?" The dragon was silent for a long time. "It just came over me. I don't know why. It just came over me, listening to the battling shouts and the war cries of Earth. I got excited and wanted to join in." "Well, you can sing for us instead," said the Iron Man. "It's a long time since anybody here on Earth has heard music of the spheres. It might do us all good." And so it was fixed. The space bat angel dragon was to send his star back into the constellation of Orion, and he was to live inside the moon, and every night he was to fly around the Earth through the heavens and sing. So his fearful shape, slowly swimming through the night sky, didn't frighten people because it was dark and he couldn't be seen. But the whole world could hear him, a strange soft music that seemed to fill the whole space, a deep weird singing, like millions of voices singing together. Meanwhile, the Iron Man was the world's hero. He went back to his scrapyard, but now everybody in the world sent him a present. Some only sent him a nail, some only sent him a car, but one rich man even sent him an ocean liner. He sprawled there in his yard, chewing away, with his one ear slightly drooped, where the white heat of that last roasting had slightly melted it. He chewed and he hummed in harmony to the singing of the tremendous slave in heaven. And the space bat angel's singing had the most unexpected effect. Suddenly the world became wonderful and peaceful. The singing got inside everybody and made them as peaceful as starry space. And blissfully, above all earlier little squabbles, the strange, soft, eerie space music began to alter all the people of the world. They stopped making weapons, and the countries began to think how they could live pleasantly alongside each other, rather than how to get rid of each other. All they wanted to do was have peace to enjoy this strange, wild, blissful music from the giant singer in space. And that's the end. What a cool book. Thanks, everyone.